Happy Wednesday! You're listening to Mama Murdered a Podcast. I'm your host, AB. This week on Mama Murdered a Podcast, we'll be covering the case of Christina Harris. Christina and her husband, Jason, lived a pretty normal and a seemingly happy life together. But when Christina suddenly died from an accidental heroin overdose, her parents, friends, and family were hell-bent on finding the truth of what really happened. Was it an accidental overdose, or was she murdered? Let's find out. We're all here for one thing and one thing only. Let's get it. Christina Ann Thompson. She was born on January 16, 1978 in Flint, Michigan. Her parents were Harvey and Kathy Thompson, and Christina was better known to her loved ones and friends as just Christy. So that's what we're going to go with. Unfortunately, Christy's dad, Harvey, passed away after losing his battle with leukemia shortly after she was born. She was actually only 8.5 months old when he passed, according to DavisonIndex.com. Christy's mom, Kathy, would go on to marry her stepdad, James May, when she was 3 years old. And for all intents and purposes, James raised Christy as his own daughter and showed her the same love that he would have if it would have been her biological father. And as good as a stepdad as James was to Christy, Kathy still made sure that Christy kept in touch with her biological dad's side of the family while she was growing up as well. So even from a very early age, Christy had love coming in from every angle. Different families and multiple parents, grandparents, whether blood related or in relation to her stepdad James's family. So it doesn't get confusing for anyone, I'm gonna refer to Christy's stepdad James as her dad. He did raise her after all. And I don't want the fact that her real father passed away at such an early age to get lost in the translation. Since James was the one that raised Christy and got to watch her grow up, I'll be pulling quotes from him versus her bio dad that passed when she was really young. After James and Kathy married, they had two more daughters together, Katrina and Patricia. And on the Fatal Flaw episode that I watched while I was researching this case, Katrina and Patricia both said that Christy was the one out of the three of the girls with the biggest personality, that she loved to have all eyes on her, that Christy was spunky, she was fun, she was beautiful, and she made herself the life of any party. She sounds like somebody that you would meet and immediately want to be friends with. Christy's dad, James, said that she was extremely bright when she was little, and he said, quote, she started walking at 9 months, and she was doing kindergarten homework in preschool. When we lived in North Carolina, she declared she was going to church, she got the sacraments, and wanted that in her life. When we started going to church, that was because of Christy. So, Christy would go on to meet a man named Jason in 1997, and she and Jason actually met at a party that Jason's brother Jeffrey and a few of his friends were throwing, and the two just immediately hit it off. And like a lot of couples, Christy and Jason were the complete opposite of one another. Jason's more reserved, more quiet, more laid back, kind of chill. And Christy was super fun, super outgoing, she never met a stranger, just bubbly. After a few years of dating, the two went on to marry on August 16th, 2003. And Christy's entire family agreed on one thing, that Christy's wedding day was easily one of the happiest days of her life. Like a lot of little girls, her wedding was something that she had dreamt about since she was young, and her wedding was her dream come true. She had that dream wedding. And although Jason had been married before and had two kids from a previous marriage, Christy and her family welcomed Jason and his kids with open arms. Christy's mom, Kathy, even said in an interview on the Fatal Flaw episode that they all realized and accepted that they weren't just getting a son-in-law, that he came with an extra family, and that everybody was excited for them to start their lives together. Jason paid child support to his ex-wife, and he seemed to be a really good father. Christy's mom and sister say that Christy and Jason got married in August, and that year for Halloween in October, Christy wore her wedding dress as her costume just so she could feel like a princess again while she wore it. And I don't even blame her. If I found a wedding dress that I loved and I only got to wear once for a few hours, I would also be looking for any good excuse to wear it out and about. So I'm not even mad at her level of genius for this. Jason worked a pretty steady job, and the two had a seemingly normal and happy life together. In 2009, Christy and Jason welcomed their first baby together. They had a little girl. And everybody that knew Christy said that she was the best mom. She loved it. She was good at it. She was born to be a mother. Jason and Christy had rented a house in Davidson, Michigan, which is a small suburb of Flint, Michigan. They had only been living there for a few short months, and the couple had just recently had their second baby together, a little girl named Callie Ann, in 2014. Christy was breastfeeding Callie-Ann, even though she had just went back to work as a manager at their local Subway sandwich shop. Somehow, she found time to pump in between being a wife, a mom, and a good employee. And as somebody who tried to breastfeed, take it from me, it is no easy task. It is time-consuming. You still have to watch what you eat. You still have to watch what you drink, etc., etc. But she was doing it, and she was doing it well. Flint, Michigan is also one of those small towns where everybody knows everybody, and it's the kind of place where you think you know your neighbors and everybody feels safe. The couple hadn't been living in the neighborhood very long, but they had met and knew a few of their neighbors. And it was on the morning of September 29, 2014, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, that Jason texted one of those neighbors named Sheila Coop to ask if Sheila would walk over to their house and check on Christy. He told the neighbor that Christy hadn't been feeling well the night before and that he hadn't been able to get a hold of her since he had left for work that morning. Jason told the neighbor Sheila that Christy had still been asleep when him and the kids left that morning, and he thought maybe Christy had overslept. And he just needed her to go over and see if Christy was awake yet, if she was up moving around, if she was, how was she feeling. So the neighbor Sheila agrees to go and check on her, and when Sheila gets across the street to Jason and Christy's house, she tries to open the front door and found that it was already unlocked. Which is weird. I don't care how small of a town you live in, you just don't leave your doors unlocked. So the neighbor Sheila kind of goes inside just a little. She's yelling, hollering, see if Christy's awake, but she doesn't get an answer. So Sheila walks around the living room and kitchen. She still doesn't see or hear anything, and she's not even seeing any signs of Christy being awake and moving at this point. But when Sheila walks into Christy and Jason's bedroom, she sees Christy still laying on the bed covered up with blankets. So she just kind of gently taps on Christy's foot to try to wake her up. And she immediately notices that Christy's unresponsive and stiff and that her skin is cold to the touch. So, naturally, Sheila kind of panics and she calls 911. She tells the 911 operator, quote, I need an ambulance immediately. I have a neighbor that I can't move. I can't turn her on her back and she's cold. Sheila also tells the 911 dispatcher that she had already checked for a pulse and that she wasn't able to find one on Christy whatsoever. Davidson police got there and started taking statements from everybody. They're getting their reports written up when Christy's family and Jason show up to the house. So Christy's dad, James, goes inside of his daughter's house only to have to come back out and tell his wife, Kathy, that their daughter's inside and she's passed away. So while the police are getting everybody's statements, Jason tells an officer that Christy had been feeling really bad the night before and that she must have still been feeling really bad that morning because she was still asleep when he left for work. Jason gave his statement to the police, but he was never formally questioned. Every time the police did try to question him, he had his lawyer present with him, and his legal advisor would request that he not answer any questions at this time. Jason had been questioned by the first responding officer after the 911 call was placed, but this officer wasn't a trained detective, and that was the only time that Jason was questioned without his attorney present for a good long while. The only time that he was forced to be questioned, anyways. The Harris house was never ruled a crime scene. There was never any evidence collected, no fingerprints, no DNA, nothing. So we're not off to a good start here. Jason told the police that Christy had been hungry the night before, that he had made her a bowl of cereal, and he had even had to help feed it to her because she had gotten really weak and was having a hard time holding the spoon herself. So he helped her up to bed and they both went to sleep. But Christy's family just wanted answers. Her family knew that she and Jason's marriage had been going through a pretty rough patch, but Christy wasn't ready to give up on her husband or her marriage. Christy had even said that she knew Jason had been texting other girls, but that she didn't think it would go any further than that, so she was trying not to worry about it. And it's not really a secret that the spouse or significant other of somebody that's killed unexpectedly is suspect number one. But was Christy's death a murder or a suicide? That was the question that her family wanted answered. Christy's body was sent for an autopsy, and the results came back on October 22nd, 2014. But when they got the results back, it was revealed that Christy had extremely high levels of heroin in her system. Her death was ruled an accidental overdose. So, with an accidental overdose, there would be very little evidence collected from the Harris house on the following days and weeks after Christy's death. But Christy's mom, Kathy, and her dad, James, both insisted that Christy would never do drugs. There were actually still a bottle of Percocets left from the C-section that she had had 4 months prior. And it wasn't just one or two pills left. There was quite a few pills left in this bottle. If she were doing drugs, I mean, she wouldn't have left those. They would be gone. And they also knew that Chrissy would never jeopardize her 4-month-old daughter by transferring heroin from herself to the breast milk that she would inevitably feed her daughter. Chrissy was always so sure to watch what she ate and drank so that it wouldn't transfer to her breast milk. She was so worried what her newborn ate that she made sure to pump enough bags of breast milk with the dates and times that she had pumped those servings of breast milk. And she even wrote the dates and stuff on the bags that she had frozen in Sharpie. And Chrissy didn't just have a few bags of breast milk. She had an entire freezer full at her house and her parents' house for them to use whenever they babysat Callie Ann. A mom that is this devoted to her kids and their health wouldn't do drugs in general, most likely. But she definitely wouldn't do drugs that she knew would transfer over through her milk. It also helps to know that Chrissy didn't have any past history of drug use. What was even weirder than the high doses of heroin in her system was the fact that Chrissy didn't have any traces of injection marks, so she wouldn't have been using needles as a means to do the heroin. So she's not shooting up. Her nasal cavities and nostrils didn't have any signs of heroin being snorted through her nasal cavity, which is also a popular way to do different kinds of drugs. But they did find heroin in Chrissy's stomach, which is weird. It's almost like she had eaten it. And in all my years of knowing drug users and researching about different ways to do drugs, there are ways that people stay off of the radar of being identified as a drug user. I've seen things like people shoot up between their toes or in their necks or snorting different drugs because snorting doesn't leave track marks. But I've never, ever, ever heard of someone eating heroin. It just doesn't happen. So, no previous drug use and no signs of a typical drug use on her body, but there's heroin in her system and in her stomach of all places. So, let's take a look at the bigger picture and see if any of this starts to make more sense. It was only 2 days after Chrissy passed away when different family members, friends, co-workers, and neighbors started to come forward to the police to voice some of their concerns. Jason's brother Jeffrey, the same brother that had thrown the party where Jason and Chrissy first met, he went to Davison police and told them that Jason had made statements to him before and that Jason had been talking about how to get rid of Chrissy. Jeffrey also told police about something that had happened just about a year before Chrissy's death. A year prior to Chrissy's death, Jason went to his brother Jeffrey and asked him to buy a plane ticket. Jason wanted Jeffrey to buy the plane ticket on his credit card so that Chrissy wouldn't see the charges on their account and he would just give him the cash back for the ticket. The ticket costed $340.98. When Jeffrey asked Jason why he didn't want Chrissy to know about the charges, Jason told him that he was using the plane ticket to go visit another woman, and Jeffrey did agree to buy the plane ticket at first. Jason told Jeffrey that he had met this woman in a chat box of a game that they had both been playing and that she lived on the East Coast. And it didn't take long before Jeffrey's conscience kicked in and he canceled the plane ticket. He says in the Fatal Flaw episode that he couldn't explain the feeling, he just knew it wasn't right. Which, cheating on your wife normally isn't the right thing to do, so I'm with Jeffrey on this one. And Jeffrey said that he did ask Jason why he couldn't just get a divorce if he didn't want to be with Chrissy anymore. And Jason told him that he couldn't get a divorce because he would have to pay child support on the girls that he and Chrissy had together. Yeah, Jason, that's normally how that works, and yeah, people still do it every single day, buddy. Jeffrey says that he distinctly remembers the police telling him that they would hate to arrest a man that just lost his wife. And Jeffrey says that he kind of wondered to himself, like, okay, but he did it. He says that it always kind of puzzled him. Police arrest grieving spouses all the time if they think they're responsible for the other one's death. When Jeffrey canceled Jason's plane ticket, he says that that's kind of the point in their relationship when things fell out and it kind of got rocky and him and Jason didn't really talk anymore. Jason had also been texting his sister, Rachel, after the plane ticket incident, and it was only a few months before Chrissy's death that Jason actually told Rachel via text message that the only way he was going to be able to leave Chrissy was going to be to kill her. That was the only option that he thought he had, so not a good look, Jason. But Jason didn't just tell his sister Rachel that he would have to kill Chrissy, though. He almost plays out in exact detail the same thing that did end up happening on the morning that Chrissy was found dead in her own bed. His text message actually say that he would have an alibi because he would be at work, that he would get a neighbor to go over, and the neighbor would find her body and that he would be in the clear. And Jeffrey and Rachel weren't the only ones going to the police to tell them that they should probably be looking into Chrissy's husband, Jason. And let me just remind you, Jeffrey and Rachel are Jason's siblings. It's his own family saying that something doesn't seem right here. Chrissy's parents, Kathy and James, also went to the Davison Police Department to tell investigators working on Chrissy's case that they should be looking into Jason to see if he's somehow involved in Chrissy's death. Kathy and James told the police about a phone bill that Chrissy had brought them a few months before her death, and the phone bill had a lot of numbers on it that were both from calls and text. And normally the way it works is, you know, you have two lines on one bill, you can see each call or text sent from each separate number. And Chrissy knew that a lot of the numbers that had been called and text from Jason's phone were to other women. She had even been able to match up times and dates of some of the calls and texts to the exact time and day that she was laying in a hospital operating room, having a C-section, giving birth to their youngest daughter. He had been on the phone with other women while she was laying on the operating table. Literally. There are even pictures of Chrissy holding their baby in a hospital bed with Jason sitting in a chair in the background with his face glued to his phone. Probably texting one of the women right beside of her. Now, all of this doesn't look or sound too good for Jason, but the fact that he had gotten himself a brand spanking new girlfriend just a week after Chrissy's death also didn't look good. And he moved this new girlfriend in just 2 months after Chrissy passed away. Now, a bag of Chrissy's breast milk had been tested back in 2015, and the testing of the breast milk came back with absolutely no drugs in the milk at all. But that was never brought to the detectives, the prosecutor, or even the medical examiner who had ruled Chrissy's death an accidental overdose, which kind of leaves me to believe that there are likely no drugs in Chrissy's system prior to her death, or you would think that the drugs would also be in the frozen bags of breast milk. Which is odd, to say the least, for someone who's supposedly using drugs frequently enough to overdose on them. Jason cashed in a pretty hefty life insurance policy for about $100,000 that Chrissy had through her job. Jason bought himself a new truck, he bought his girlfriend a new Chevy Impala, and he bought a third vehicle, you know, because everybody needs an extra daily driver. Jason also used the life insurance money to buy himself a bigger, nicer, fancier, nicer house than the one that he and Chrissy had been renting before she passed. He had also stopped going to work regularly. And Jason would eventually be fired from his job at United Plastics, a plastic company that he had been working for, only a few months after Chrissy's death. Why did he get fired, you might be wondering? Well, because his random drug screenings were coming back positive for drugs that he wasn't prescribed to and or wasn't supposed to be taking. And when Jason was asked about these positive drug tests, he would tell people that he only failed for marijuana, which I don't believe. Both of Chrissy's sisters said this was pretty hard to watch because it was almost like watching Jason live Chrissy's dream with her life insurance money. And he was living this dream with some new woman. But was he living his dream with Chrissy's blood money? And how many more people thought that Jason could be involved? The answer? Lots and lots of people. Rachel went to the police and handed over all the texts that she had gotten from Jason. You know, the ones where he said that he would have a neighbor find her dead and he would have a solid alibi because he would be at work. She did hand all of that over. Chrissy's sister Patricia had a friend whose brother worked with Jason at United Plastics before he got fired. And this friend let Chrissy's sister know that her brother was saying that the rumor at work was going around that Jason had murdered her sister for insurance money, which is hard to hear even if you already suspect it to be true. This wasn't even close to all the things that would be uncovered about Jason, though. While police were interviewing Jason's co-workers, someone told them that Jason had tried to crush up 5 Xanax pills and put them in Chrissy's water, but Chrissy had taken one sip of the water, and she refused to drink any more of it. She said it tasted awful. There were also other co-workers saying that Jason had been asking everybody at work if they knew of any pills that would be tasteless and that would put Chrissy in a state of unconsciousness so that he would be able to move her body easily after she was killed. And ABCNews.com reports that investigators also found a man that Jason had hired, who was a paid hitman, to kill Chrissy. The hitman had been doing surveillance on Chrissy, getting to know her routine, her day-to-day schedule, the ins and outs of her life, and he was arrested on charges that were unrelated to Jason or Chrissy, thank God. And there were also quite a few people that Jason worked with at United Plastics that said that Jason had asked them on more than one occasion to kill his wife, even offering to pay people up to $5,000 to kill her. Jason was asking literally anybody and everybody, and he wasn't even attempting to be discreet with what he was planning to do. But this isn't cold hard facts. It's hard to convict someone on murder charges when the medical examiner says that the death was an accidental overdose. It's even harder to convict somebody on murder with no concrete, physical, actual evidence. You can talk about killing someone all day, every day, but until you actually do it, or until you attempt to do it and someone can prove it, there's not a whole lot that can be done. There isn't a law that reads, he said he was going to kill her, now she's dead, lock him up and throw away the key, because as good as that sounds, that's just not how it works. So at this point in the investigation, the police are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. They can't charge Jason with anything because they don't have enough to prove that he killed Christy in a jury trial. So they just kind of have to buy their time and wait for the family to get their justice. But Kathy and James, they weren't just going to sit back and watch Jason get away with murder. And they did their part. They played nice with Jason so that they could still see their grandkids. And they never let him know that they suspected him at all. While James and Kathy were at Jason's fancy new house with his fancy new girlfriend, Jason mentioned to Christy's dad, James, that he had been having problems with his laptop. James was a tech guy. He's good with computers and he knows how to fix them. But the diagnostic program that James had on his home computer, he was going to have to plug Jason's computer into it to figure out what was wrong with it. So James tells him that he'll take it home, he'll look at it, he'll fix it, and he'll bring it back on their next visit because they visit with their grandkids pretty often. This wasn't so lucky for Jason, though, because James was going to have to take Jason's laptop home in order to fix it. When James got home, he immediately called Mike Beer, who is the assistant prosecutor, and he was going to be able to get a search warrant for Jason's laptop pronto. Mike Beer is adamant that Kathy sent him a different email every single day begging him to get justice in her daughter's case. Even today, he remains adamant on the fact that at the time, there really wasn't anything more that they could have done aside from what they had already done up to this point. But now they have a search warrant, and with a search warrant, they can go through Jason's laptop. And when they do, they find a picture of Jason with a tray sitting in front of him that I can only assume are either lines of cocaine or heroin or crushed up pills formed to make a line. You can clearly see lines of some sort of drug on this tray sitting in front of him, and you can also clearly see a dollar bill rolled up to make a homemade straw, which would be used to snort whatever powder is on this tray in Jason's right hand. Which is pretty common for people who snort different things. They don't carry straws around with them, I don't think. Normally, this wouldn't be very good evidence in a case. Except for this time. This time it means that Jason does have access to different street drugs, which had never been able to be proven up until this point. And every time Jason was asked to recount the timeline of events from the night before and the morning of his wife passing away, he always had the same story. That Christy had been fighting the common cold the night before, he fed her a bowl of cereal, helped her get into bed, and they both went to sleep. The next morning, he got himself and his two young girls up before he left for his job at United Plastics, where he later called the neighbor and the neighbor found Christy dead. That's always been his story, and it never changed and it never varied in any way. But this story had only ever been told to people asking in the community or people from the family that had asked. It had never been told to police detectives or investigators. This case would end up at a standstill for many, many years. And Kathy and James didn't feel any better about it when they found out that there hadn't been a homicide in the city of Davidson for over 55 years. So now Christy's parents are kind of wondering if Davidson Police Department can even handle a homicide case. Kathy and James had requested on more than one occasion that the Davidson police transfer the case to the Michigan State Police. And finally, in 2016, in August, the case did change hands from the Davidson police to the Michigan State Police. And Kathy is still sending assistant prosecutor Mike Beer an email every single day to make sure that he doesn't forget about her daughter's case. But Kathy wasn't just sending these emails to the assistant prosecutor. She was sending them to anybody and everybody that she thought had any kind of pull that would be able to help her at all. And apparently, some of Christy and Jason's neighbors thought that their house was a place where people did in fact go to do drugs, since Kathy got various different emails basically saying that if you hang out with or live with drug users, that it isn't very far-fetched that you yourself would be a drug user, in reference to her daughter Christy. And even though Kathy knew Christy would never do drugs and that she would never ingest something that she knew could harm her 4-month-old daughter, in this case, they couldn't have been more wrong about her daughter. maybe Jason was using drugs at the house and maybe people knew it, but Christy wasn't, and I don't think she was aware of what was going on if it was. So in order for Kathy and James to get somebody, anybody, to pay attention to them, they filed a wrongful death suit against the police. But they needed to find an attorney that would be willing to go against the police, and attorney Alec Gibbs seemed to be up to the challenge. So that same attorney, Alec Gibbs, did file the wrongful death suit, and Christy's parents kind of jokingly referred to this as a backwards OJ, because normally in these types of situations, you would go through the criminal side of court, and if you still feel like you didn't get justice, then you would go through the civil side and file a wrongful death suit or a judgment. Anybody can file a judgment. But in this case, they're going to let the civil side go first and then hope from there that the criminal side would come from the civil suits, which is completely backwards of how this normally happens. But this did seem like the only way to get Jason in for real questioning with real detectives and real investigators. Because even though they had been trying to play nice with Jason, their act was up now. Because up until this point, Jason had kind of just invoked his Fifth Amendment right, and all of his previous questionings had never really gotten anywhere. But that's not really how it works in this case. In this case, during a civil suit, you kind of get subpoenaed and you have no choice but to answer the questions truthfully. And with this being the first time that Jason had to recount the events of the day that Christy died, his story didn't exactly add up like it had before when random people or family members had asked. So on September 20th, 2018, when Jason was asked if it was normal for him to try to call or text his wife after he was already at work, he said that it was. But the investigators questioning him were able to prove that it wasn't normal for him at all to call or text his wife after he had already gotten to work. Then they asked if he slept in the bed beside his wife the night before she passed, and he claims that he did, even though his side of the bed looked unslept in and untouched. And when Jason was finally shown a picture of him with literal drugs in front of him and a rolled up dollar bill in his hand, his excuse was kind of priceless. Jason claimed that this was him explaining to his oldest daughter how not to do drugs. This was his big parent-to-kid talk about drugs and the dangers that they could bring. Like, I'm sorry, what? And finally, in 2019, the medical examiner that had originally ruled Christy's death an accidental overdose was finally shown the mounds and mounds of evidence against Jason, which did show signs of homicide. And after finally being shown the evidence that he had never seen and didn't even know existed before this, he did finally change the manner of death from accidental overdose to homicide. And now, since the Michigan State Police could do something about it because the case was in their hands now, so once the matter of death was changed, the investigators were able to pull the statements and reports that they had gotten from people before this. They were able to use Jason's deposition statement from the civil case filed against him by Kathy and James, and all the lies that he had been called in, while he wiped sweat off his forehead. Go watch it. It's awful. They could use all of this and all of those statements and reports that they had collected over the last few years. The only problem with Christy's death ruling being changed from an accidental overdose to a suicide is the fact that no one had collected any evidence from the Harris house on the day that Christy was found dead. And since there hadn't been a homicide in Davidson for over 55 years, the police were a little out of practice. Even though the case is being handled by the Michigan State Police now, there were a lot of things that were done wrong in this case up until this point. The house was never sealed off. Evidence was never collected. The thing that was almost kind of done right, that was somebody snapped a few pictures of the way the house was found. They could have at least taped the house off until the medical examiner came back with the ruling, even though that wouldn't have really made a difference in this case. That's still just normally how it works. So all of this makes for an extremely hard way to prove somebody was murdered, and Jason had bought himself a bigger, nicer house with Christy's life insurance money, so he didn't even live in the same house anymore, so that house was no help. James and Kathy did end up winning the civil case against James, and he was found liable for Christy's death. He was then ordered to pay $2 million in damages. But, just as luck would have it, the evidence that they needed to convict Christy's murderer had been right in front of the investigators the entire time. It had been in every report, every statement, and all of Jason's recountings of the night before and the day of Christy's passing. The cereal. But that wasn't all. They would also be able to use the breast milk, and it's about to get wild. The same breast milk that had been tested back in 2015 that showed that there were no drugs in Christy's system, they were going to be able to use that because every bag of milk had been dated before it had been frozen, and she had pumped the same night that she had been fed the bowl of cereal. That would be the smoking gun that the family and the prosecutor needed to finally legally be able to point the finger at someone who may be responsible for Christy's death. And obviously, Jason didn't realize that Christy's frozen breast milk would be the key to convicting him, but James and Kathy had over 50 bags of breast milk that had been unused that Christy had frozen before her death for them to use later for when they helped babysit. So, Detective Sergeant Joshua Dirks, who was also a detective sergeant for the Michigan State Police, said that the testing of Christy's breast milk would be the key to figuring out what really happened to Christy Harris. Though, this wasn't something that had been done often or even ever, for that matter. And the cereal that kept coming up over and over again, but nobody could figure out how it fit in until now. Finally, the new DA for the Michigan State Police would file charges on Jason and he would be arrested in August of 2019. And they had a few hefty charges that they were going to throw at him. He was charged with one count of first-degree murder, one count of solicitation of murder, and one count of the delivery of a controlled substance causing a death. The prosecuting attorney, David Layton, said, quote, "We believe Jason Harris murdered his wife. We believe he put heroin into her cereal and milk the night that she died after getting it from someone, thinking it would be tasteless and odorless, much like he had asked his co-workers multiple times." He also added that one of Christy's friends said that she feared Jason might harm her, saying, quote, "She told a friend that if something happens to me, look at Jason." So they laid out their theory that Jason had fed his wife a lethal dose of heroin in a bowl of cereal and that he let his wife lay down in bed until he knew she was dead, but that he didn't sleep in the bed with her, which is why the bed looked untouched on his side. But the kicker would be how they could prove that. How could they prove that Christy didn't just decide that night that today would be a good day to put some heroin in her cereal and milk? Well, Kathy and James did have over 50 bags of breast milk, and a bag had been tested before, but what if they tested all 50 bags and none of them showed drugs? Then maybe that would prove that Christy wasn't a drug user and that she wouldn't have willingly ate cereal laced with heroin. Not one single bag had even the smallest trace of any kind of drug whatsoever when all 50 bags were tested. Jason's trial finally started in November 2021, and Kathy and James had purposely kept those bags and bags of breast milk because they knew that if this day ever did come, that those bags of drug-free breast milk would prove that their daughter was not only a drug-free woman, but that she was also a good mom who cared about what went into her kids' body, because she knew that whatever went into her body would end up in her infant baby's body too. They had kept those bags of breast milk for 7 years. Jason's brother Jeffrey testified to everything that he witnessed, heard, and ever saw. And even though Jason's sister Rachel had initially went to the police back in 2014 and told them about the text that Jason had sent about wanting to get rid of his wife, when it came time to testify against him, she claimed that she couldn't recall anything. The co-worker that knew about the 5 Xanax pills in Christy's water testified, and the hitman that Jason had hired to kill Christy, well, you know, the one that got arrested while he was staking out Christy like prey, he also testified at trial. With all of this evidence finally stacking up against Jason, he was finally found guilty on all 3 charges that he was facing. The first-degree murder, the solicitation of murder, and the delivery of a controlled substance causing a death on November 17th, 2021, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge that presided over Jason's trial said it best when he told Jason, quote, "The jury didn't believe your lies, and now you've finally been exposed for the selfish, lying murderer that you are." He also said, "What you wanted, all the stuff, you sacrificed your daughters, you took away their mother." While Jason listened to the family impact statements, he just sat staring at them, kind of expressionless. And when Jason finally got his chance to speak, he said that he stood by his innocence and that he would respect whatever decision that the judge decided would be his fate. Click on Detroit, Michigan asked Christy's mom, Kathy, how this punishment and conviction made her feel. And Kathy said that she never felt so tense in her life and that she had never been able to work up the nerve to visit Christy's grave before this because she felt like Christy hadn't been able to rest in peace until justice was served. So now Kathy would be able to go visit Christy's grave and hopefully she can feel like she helped in the fact that her daughter can now rest in peace and she had gotten some justice for her. And I don't think they would have gotten that justice without Kathy's persistence. But there's also a GoFundMe page that's still up and active that is supposed to help with Kathy and James getting custody of Chrissy's two daughters. I'm pretty sure that Jason's parents are also trying to gain full custody of the girls. I'm not sure if that matter's been worked out yet or not. I will link the GoFundMe page below in the show notes, and if that's something that you're interested in helping with, then it'll be there. If not, that's fine too. Well, it's been fun. Let's do it again. Same time, same place, next Wednesday. See you then.
That's how my mama
murdered a podcast.